Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. This week, we continue our new series in audio form for the first time on these airwaves of Matt Cale's great essay and booklet, Faith of the Future. In this second part, the author brings us to the inexorable realization that Western civilization, founded on a false Jewish spiritual basis at its very inception, is now doomed beyond any hope of revival and must pass from this earth. In its place, a new civilization, based on a purified and more powerful and evolved National Socialism, will arise and once again give full scope to the potential of Aryan man. These are the words of Matt Cale. Listen.
Twilight of the West. As we have seen, the ultimate source of the decline of the West lies in the failure of the polar ideology, or mythos, which has formed its foundation. Once the dogmas of the dominant faith were effectively called into question and challenged, an unavoidable development, given the preposterous assertions of Christian doctrine on the one hand and the truth-seeking nature of Aryan man on the other. It was only a matter of time before the entire cultural order which rested upon it was itself called into doubt. With the loss of belief in its guiding ideology, that is, with the dying out of Christianity, the West has lost faith in itself, and its death becomes inevitable. For the Christian worldview has stood at the very heart and soul of the West, permeating its art and culture. It was no accident, for instance, that in times past, the term Christendom was synonymous with the West. Cultures live and die with their gods. That the God of the West should have died was foreordained from the very beginning, and it is in this sense that Nietzsche's celebrated pronouncement must be understood. For how could a Middle Eastern import permanently satisfy the real spiritual needs of Aryan man? Yahweh, Jehovah, could murder Zeus and Jupiter, Odin and Thor, but how could he maintain forever the fiction that he was the real father of their children? If we disregard all ephemeral revivalism, it can be clearly seen that the culture of the West has now reached the point of practical disbelief and atheism, a fact which is reflected in every field of modern cultural endeavor. Atonality and the eruption of alien rhythms in music, formlessness and insanity in painting and the plastic arts, cheapness and vulgarity in literature and on the stage, vapidity and grotesque ugliness of line in architecture. All of this bears disturbing witness to a spiritual emptiness and sterility, to disorientation and a lack of direction, to an absence of values and standards, and an ethos to inform artistic expression. It is modern technology, however, which, by assuming a utilitarian function in a soulless, materialistic, produce and consume society, rather than serving a higher cultural purpose, offers the conclusive statement that Western culture has nothing more to say. The West, as a culture, has exhausted all of its historical possibilities. It has no new direction in which it can go. This, of course, does not mean that Aryan man himself no longer possesses a creative capability. But his genius and talents must now find expression in a post-Western context. Western civilization itself cannot experience a rebirth. It has exploited and expended its potential and destroyed its one hope for a resurgence, and now it can only wallow in decadence and die. The old order is doomed. Not only is the final collapse of the West inevitable, but for a new order to emerge, such a collapse is historically imperative. For only out of a new formation can there be the possibility of racial salvation for Aryan man, Indeed, this civilization must die, so that upon its ruins a new and greater culture may now rise. That is the meaning and message of contemporary events. That is the iron will of history. The tragedy of 1945. The fall of Berlin to the Eastern hordes in 1945 represents a decisive turning point in the history of the world. Very few have yet grasped its real import, although many have argued the hypothetical possibilities of a different denouement to that fateful conflict. Unfortunately, the scenario was predetermined and involved elements which even superhuman agency could not contain or overcome. The events of 1945 were, in fact, but the concluding scene of a great tragic drama which began on April 20, 1889, when a very remarkable figure made his appearance in this world to herald the start of the second half of human history. But although the birth of this extraordinary personality signals the beginning of a new age, his earthly work was constrained by exigencies under an old order. And it is here that the element of tragedy is introduced. For he came into the world during a historical cusp, during the period when one order is dying and another has yet to be born, which foredoomed all of his finest efforts and precluded the possibility of a fulfillment of his idea during his mortal lifetime. It is perhaps the greatest of historical ironies that it was Adolf Hitler, the father of a new age, who offered the West its last opportunity for resuscitation and renewal. By infusing new spirit into the old civilization and by defending its major institutional forms, as the Führer proposed, it is conceivable that the old order might have been able to protract its historical life, perhaps even for another millennium. It was not to be, however. The decay was too advanced. In its diseased and delirious condition, the West rejected the one hand which could have rescued it from impending death. Beyond that, however, the contradiction between the values of the old and the new was simply too great. In the final analysis, these values were mutually exclusive. And so the Second World War was, in fact, a war against the West, as critics of National Socialism have charged. It represented a titanic struggle between the old and the new. Unfortunately, the entrenched forces of the old, even in their decadent and moribund state, proved momentarily too formidable for the incipient new. It must be noted here, and this is not without significance, that the Third Reich, the provisional state of the new, was itself heavily and fatally infected by ideas and elements carried over from the old. The new had not completely prevailed against the old. For that, it had hardly had time. In fact, it had barely begun. The very nature of its introduction, which was dictated by the political and social realities of contemporary Germany, involved a gradual, evolutionary transition from the old to the new, rather than violent upheaval, something which would have been neither feasible nor justifiable under existing historical circumstances. In consequence, however, we find that by the outbreak of war in 1939, old thinking, old attitudes, old habits, and old interests continued to persist in many quarters of German society. The new ways were still far too tenuous. Not even the space of a single generation had been granted for the introduction of necessary radical change, with the result that the new thinking and new attitudes which could have produced the extra margin of revolutionary morale to effect a different sequel never had an opportunity to develop properly. Thus, the outcome of this tragic drama could not have been other than what it was. Fate had chosen the time and the place and had set the stage, and events proceeded in their appointed manner. Yet, even this cataclysmic tragedy, with the immolation of its godlike protagonist and his martyr people, was historically necessary for two reasons. First, it resulted in a decisive blow to the old order, a mortal blow from which it can never recover and which assures its disappearance from the stage of world history. And secondly, by clearing the field, it has served to release the new movement from any lingering constraints, inhibitions, or commitments with respect to the old, thus enabling it to acquire the necessary freedom for the fulfillment of its revolutionary mission. This is particularly important to consider, for not only was 1945 a watershed in the larger history of the world, it was a great divide in the development of the movement as well. A phase which had been essentially political and military now became spiritual, yes, even religious. Militarily and politically, National Socialism stood defeated in 1945 completely. Had it represented merely a political or military structure, it could not have survived the collapse. The idea of Adolf Hitler, however, was more than just political or military. It was above all spiritual, and spiritual ideas cannot be broken by brute force or military means alone. And yet, military might and physical compulsion were the only resources at the disposal of the old order. Morally and spiritually, it was bankrupt. And so its apparent defeat of National Socialism in reality proved to be something quite different. For in the contest, the new idea had lost none of its integrity, its inner substance, but remained spiritually undefeated, awaiting only the proper moment to make its reappearance. Indeed, it was precisely in this vital area that it proved itself stronger than ever. Unimpeded by expedient, i.e., political, considerations of any kind, it was now completely free and unfettered to pursue its high destiny. Out of the crucible of the most horrible suffering and hardship, a movement had emerged, inwardly purged, perfected in its faith, fortified, steeled, and infinitely more conscious of its holy mission on this earth. As we now move further into the future, we begin to perceive the faint outline of an awesome design. Adolf Hitler and his people had to sacrifice themselves so that the wonderful new idea could one day be reborn in exalted form as a glorious beacon and symbol for embattled Aryan mankind everywhere. That was the purpose and essence of their heroic Olympian struggle. And it is now upon this sacred foundation, one forged and hallowed in the flames of monumental tragedy, that a regenerate movement must build, and in so doing, give eternal meaning to the precious blood sacrifice of those martyred millions, representing a higher humanity who fell with the faith of a new age in their hearts. Worldview of a New Age. Today we are witness to the death throes of a civilization. An entire order is collapsing. The old cannot be restored. It is doomed. The confusion and uncertainty we now see is but a prelude to the utter chaos and agony which awaits. When the bright star of civilization implodes, it creates a spiritual black hole, one which acts in the same awesome manner as its material counterpart. All spiritual reality is impacted into nothingness by anti-spirit, as it were. No purpose, no meaning, no values, no standards, no principles, no roots, no direction, no ideals, no truth, no honor, no beauty, no excellence, no order, no gods, nothing remains. Only that which is able to distance itself from the old world and remove itself from its terrible gravitational pull can escape the all-consuming vortex of the collapse. In this latter category will be found all those now spiritually alienated who somehow manage to find their way to a new world. Today, there exists a brooding sense of despair, a despair reflecting more than a mere loss of faith in some governmental regime or social system, but touching every aspect of life and existence. Men cry out for something to believe in, for something to guide and inform their lives. Perceptive minds are searching for purpose and direction, for a new focus of faith to replace that which has been hopelessly and irretrievably lost. But where is such an idea, such a faith? As has been noted, Aryan man has suffered for over 1,000 years from a spiritual tension caused by the intrusion of alien ideology into his natural thought world, a process which has distorted the culture of the West from the very beginning and prevented the fulfillment of a higher mission. Not only was an incredible cosmology foisted upon the reluctant Aryan by the new creed, but he was forced to accept a statement of teleological purpose which amounted to a declaration of war against the natural order and its eternal laws. God was divorced from his creation. Nature itself became suspect. The spirit was set at enmity with the flesh. Man was declared inherently and hopelessly sinful. God became an external object, a remote, arbitrary, despotic figure, whom man should fear and before whom he should cringe and cower. God was also seen as kind and benevolent. Accordingly, he was said to have agreed not to torment and torture man in perpetuity, as he had planned, if man in turn would consent to ritual expiation through one of his three parts. By implication, responsible, upright behavior was denigrated in favor of forgiveness through divine grace. The preoccupation of religion in the West for over a millennium with salvation of the individual soul, without regard for any larger racial considerations, has had the most disastrous consequences. Not only has it encouraged the grossest form of spiritual pettiness and selfishness, but it has had an even more harmful effect. By assigning cardinal importance to individual salvation, it thereby downgraded the well-being of one's own kind, of one's folk and race, to something of lesser significance. The community of believers, red and yellow, black and white, was more precious in the sight of the church fathers than the community of flesh and blood, love for which was denounced as a species of idolatry. Whereupon, the spiritual marrow of Aryan man was left to marinate in a moral concoction of meekness, mildness, resist not evil, and love thine enemy. Finally, coupled with all of the foregoing measures for moral disarmament, there was added a Judeo-olatrous component. Those of the House of Israel were conveniently exempted from all of the above, on the grounds that as chosen ones they should not be disturbed by such unnecessary considerations. The modern condition presents itself as the end result of this extraordinary doctrine.